Hello and welcome to Science World. This week we'll hear about the findings made by an American geologist and his team that might make it possible to forecast how strong an earthquake may be. Researchers released a study this past week that linked a warm and wet ancient Mars with volcanic activity. Science World's Bob Doody will tell us more. And have you ever wondered why your favorite basketball player wasn't able to make that crucial shot, or why the talented football player missed a goal he should have made? Today, Dr. Vikram Chib will tell us what he and his colleagues at Caltech found out about why talented athletes fail to perform under pressure. We'll have these stories and more for you on today's edition of VOA Science, Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. Scientists know where earthquakes are likely to occur, but not when. Now, however, an American geologist and his team have found that it may be possible to forecast just how strong an earthquake may be. Art Chimes has the details.
The Earth's crust is made of a mosaic of tectonic plates that move slowly, sometimes sliding under one another. Where that happens, it's called a subduction zone, earthquakes can occur.
They're the kind of earthquake that made the big Japan earthquake in 2011 and the Sumatra earthquake and tsunami in 2004. So they can be the real killers.
That's Timothy Dixon, a geologist at the University of South Florida. He and his colleagues are using high-precision GPS measurements to detect slow-slip events, sort of slow-motion earthquakes that can't be felt or even detected by standard instruments.
So what we think these slow-slip events are telling us is they're letting off steam, so to speak, in areas of the fault. And if they let off enough steam, that part of the fault won't rupture.
That's key, because the more of the fault that ruptures, the more powerful the earthquake is. The scientists set up a network of GPS receivers 15 years ago in Costa Rica to measure the occasional slow-slip events, which take place only every year or two. The last one was 3 months before a 2012 earthquake. People always want to know when an earthquake is going to happen, and this technology can't predict that. But Dixon says knowing how strong the earthquake is likely to be gives officials time to upgrade building codes, reinforce infrastructure, and make other preparations.
You know, the earthquake is more or less inevitable, even if you don't know exactly when it's going to happen. Since you know it's going to happen and you know how big it's going to be, you can prepare accordingly.
Timothy Dixon says other earthquake-prone subduction zones could benefit from this technology, but for now it can only be used in places where the zone is not too far offshore, because GPS receivers need to see satellites overhead, and they can't do that underwater. A scientific paper presenting Dixon's findings is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
Exploratory Mars missions, such as NASA's popular Curiosity rover, have provided more and more evidence that Mars at one time was warm enough for water to flow on its surface. Science World's Bob Doody tells us more.
Researchers from Brown University in the U.S. and Israel's Weizmann Institute of Science have released a study that found that ancient, warm, and wet periods on the red planet probably took place in brief and sporadic spurts of time. The scientists suggest that the periods of warmth and flowing water on Mars some 3.7 billion years ago may have been the result of the expulsion of gases due to volcanic activity. The U.S.-Israeli study combined the impact of volcanic activity with fresh climatic data that was gathered by the various Mars probes to create and update new Mars climate models. Studying those newer climate models, researchers found several factors that would make it difficult for a warmer and wetter red planet to exist. They said the Mars atmosphere was so thin, it would be tough, if not impossible, for the red planet to retain enough heat to allow for water to flow freely on its surface. They also suggested that our sun, many years ago, wasn't quite as powerful as it is today. But ongoing research of the red planet's geological features has suggested that when water flowed some 3.7 billion years ago, there was a lot of volcanic activity taking place. Along with lava, ash, and other materials, volcanoes also pump out a good amount of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. To reach their findings, the research team generated a model that examined how sulfuric acid might react with the extensive amounts of dust in the ancient Martian atmosphere. The model suggested that the particles of sulfuric acid attached themselves onto the dust particles in the Martian atmosphere. The combined particles of dust and sulfuric acid would have reduced the ability to reflect the rays of the sun. And they also found that the sulfur dioxide gas pumped into the atmosphere by the volcanoes would also have created a slight greenhouse effect that provided just enough warmth to the equatorial region of Mars to allow water to flow. The researchers said that warm Martian temperatures and flowing water on its surface ended with the cessation of the red planet's volcanic activity. The study outlining their findings was published this week by the journal Nature Geoscience. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
The World Health Organization reports it is launching two initiatives to stimulate the development of better and faster Ebola diagnostic tests for use in the heavily disease-infected West African countries. Lisa Schlein reports.
The World Health Organization says Ebola diagnostic tests are urgently needed to stem the transmission of this fatal disease in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. It says efforts to contain the Ebola outbreaks in West Africa are hampered by cumbersome, slow, and complex diagnostic tests. More than 12 WHO mobile laboratories have been deployed in West Africa. The test they use provides very accurate results when performed by trained staff, which is not always available, and each test requires a full tube of blood, takes from 2 to 6 hours, and costs around $100. WHO Emerging and Epidemic Zoonotic Diseases team leader Pierre Fomenti says these requirements are difficult to meet in West African settings, severely limiting the ability to test for the disease. When the number of Ebola cases in West Africa begins to decrease, he says great efforts will be needed to chase down the last Ebola case to declare the epidemic over.
So we will need in 4 to 6 months from now to increase the number of laboratory tests to be sure that we are not missing cases. To do that increase, we need to change our strategy in terms of laboratory. We need to augment the number of tests. We will really need to find the very last cases of Ebola.
Dr. Fomenti says the WHO is minimizing the barriers faced by diagnostic companies to develop and deploy their tests. He says the UN agency will be collaborating with manufacturers, academic researchers, and staff from Doctors Without Borders, among others, to move the process forward. He says in 4 months, two types of tests will be in the pipeline. One is a rapid test, and the other is an automatic version of the current test. He says laboratory technicians will need to diagnose between 1,000 and 10,000 cases per day.
So you need a lot of these kits. And today it's not possible to do that with the capacity that I was mentioning, who are international mobile lab based on very high expertise. We really need easy-to-use diagnostic tests, and we will need, of course, to build the lab that we are talking about for each district, but also to train the people to do this test.
WHO officials say the new rapid diagnostic tests should produce results in 15 to 30 minutes, cost just a few dollars, and have no biosafety requirements beyond wearing personal protective equipment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We heard a few minutes ago about how volcanism affected the climate of ancient Mars. So for today's Science World Quick Quiz, we've got a question about volcanoes. Now, when you're thinking of an erupting volcano, many of us envision, along with the violent explosions of fire and smoke, a thick and heavy stream of incredibly hot, molten rock flowing down its sides. What do scientists call that hot-flowing volcanic rock? Is it A, pumice, B, magma, or C, lava? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
For a really good look at the night sky, stay out of the city. Artificial light from street lamps, buildings, signs, and cars blocks out any chance to really see the stars. Roseanne Skirbel joined an advocate for darker skies in Washington, where his group wants to dim the lights for people's health and the health of the planet.
The Earth glitters from space. What the astronauts see as they circle the globe are the lights that flood our cities. That light creates a kind of orange haze that keeps us from seeing the stars. This is light pollution, says Jim Doherty, president of the International Dark Sky Association.
Light pollution is outdoor lighting that's not serving the task that it's designed for, and in fact is either wasted or worse, has harmful adverse effects.
Doherty says too much light is bad for your health. Studies find it disrupts sleep patterns, affects hormones, and is linked to some cancers. And it is also bad for the planet.
So there's a direct connection between the needless and harmful lighting and the excess generation. We're worried about climate change. We're just putting carbon dioxide up there. If we're burning natural gas or burning coal, we're causing global warming by sending light straight up into the sky.
But how much light is too much? Doherty takes us to a popular neighborhood on Capitol Hill, where closely spaced globe-style street lamps shed light in all directions. He says it's excessive. But the glare doesn't bother this couple out for an evening stroll.
It makes me feel safe, and I definitely feel like I can see all around me. I know no one's, gonna hurt me or anything like that, so that is just comforting.
The area around here is nice, it's populated, so the lighting is a good amount. It's not too bright, and it's just the right setting for a romantic mood if you want to come out for dinner on 8th Street.
Doherty says twice the number of street lamps were installed than necessary to make the sidewalks safe. And they're more decorative than functional, sending light into the sky where it is not needed.
Fact is, the right amount of light is the right amount of light, and if you double it, then you do not increase the public safety benefit, but you do increase the cost, you increase the energy use, you increase the climate impacts and the health effects. So this is a classic example of overlighting.
Our next stop is an apartment complex that has a combination of traditional floodlights that illuminate the grounds and walls, as well as more modern lamps that send light downward in one spot where it's needed.
And the facade of the building is dark. There's no light pollution going into their homes, so their health is being protected.
There are signs of new lighting on the broad avenues near the U.S. Capitol, where shielded sidewalk lights aid passersby.
Pretty soon in streets now, we're not going to need street lights because car headlights have become so bright, they're so effective. We use illuminated systems, paint and stripe markers and reflectors, so we don't really need street lights, but we will need sidewalk lighting. They're lower, they're dimmer, they're more efficient, and they get the job done without wasting all that money and all that energy.
With awareness comes action, Doherty says, as cities embrace new measures to curb waste and protect public health.
In some communities, they're adopting new technologies that they dim the light after, say, 1 a.m. when people don't really need it. So that's an important way to save. They're also developing technologies now where when you step into a park or when you drive your car down a street, the lights come on because they have motion sensors. They come on when there's someone there and then they turn off.
Lights controlled by such devices can reduce lighting by 90% and still be effective. Doherty hopes more communities adopt options like that so in the future we can reclaim the night sky. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
High school and college students throughout Los Angeles have been preparing for a machine-building competition that challenges their science and creativity skills as well as their patience. Elizabeth Lee in Venice, California, has the story.
At the end of a school day, a physics classroom at Animo Venice Charter High School is transformed into a workshop. For the last 2 months, six students, with the help of their physics teacher, Christina Hanush, have been trying to build a machine that erases a chalkboard.
That's a simple task, and they have to come up with a whole crazy machine that has as many chain reactions as possible to, in the end, erase that chalkboard.
It's called a Rube Goldberg machine, named after the American Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist and inventor who specialized in drawing complex machines that performed simple tasks. In less than a week, the students will be entering their machine in a citywide competition in the regional Rube Goldberg Machine Contest. 14-year-old Kelly McNamee is one of the team members.
I'm kind of nervous and excited because we're not done yet, but we're getting there and we're almost done.
But even getting to this point has not been easy, says Melissa Garcia.
The most challenging part is trying to not get frustrated.
Anoush says getting all the chain reactions to work is anything but simple.
They need to be persistent because we've probably run this 50 times and it's only worked twice.
It's hard not to blame other people or ourselves. And we sort of have to keep working together and find a solution.
Melissa Garcia and her teammates find solutions in physics and everyday objects such as marbles, a toilet seat, and a toy train. The objects came from students' homes and their neighborhood streets. Hanush says the goal is not just a complex machine that works, but one that is also creative.
Just combining all of their knowledge that they have about everything in life and then working as a team and putting it together, I think it's just an incredibly valuable experience.
Melissa Garcia says she didn't know what to expect when they first started.
I think we're all impressed and amazed by what we created.
In just a few days, these students will find out if their machine will impress and amaze the judges on competition day. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. When thinking of an erupting volcano, many of us envision, along with the violent explosions of fire and smoke, a thick and heavy stream of incredibly hot molten rock flowing down its sides. What do scientists call that hot volcanic rock? Is it A, pumice, B, magma, or C, lava? Well, the answer is C, because once this hot molten rock blasts out of a volcano, it's called lava. Before it exits the volcano in an eruption, this material, which makes its way up into the volcano from below the Earth's crust, is called magma. Answer choice A, pumice, according to the Oxford Pocket Dictionary, is a very light and porous volcanic rock that is formed when a gas-rich froth of glassy lava solidifies rapidly. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A talented and well-trained professional basketball player is standing at the free throw line, dribbling his ball as he prepares to make his one foul shot. It's a very important game. The score is tied, and there are virtually seconds left on the clock until the end of the game. So if he makes the basket, his team wins the game, and he is carried off on the shoulders of his teammates a hero. But if he misses, the regular game ends and then goes into overtime, where the team could very well lose. Now, what's going on in the basketball player's mind that could determine whether he is successful or not? What could cause him to, as they say in sports jargon, choke and miss the basket? A team of researchers from the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, led by Dr. Vikram Chib, has found evidence that what's really going on is that the player or performer could become worried about losing a potentially valuable prize. And the more that person is afraid of losing, the worse they tend to perform. Dr. Chib joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research and findings.
There are a lot of things going on here right now, right? There's numerous incentives. There's the social incentive associated with, you know, performing well for his teammates, as well as sometimes monetary incentives. So Athletes can make millions of dollars in bonuses depending on their performance. So all of those things come into play that and can cause somebody to choke under pressure. And what we found in our study was that it seems, at least in the case when large financial stakes are on the line, that how you perceive losses or how you feel about losses can really have a dramatic impact on your performance.
How much of this anxiety, these problems that basketball players or even artists who perform concerts or whatever, how much of the problems they have with choking results from mere psyching themselves, overthinking?
So it's hard to know exactly what's going on in those situations. We've studied this specific case as looking at high-stakes financial conditions, but it seems that choking could be psychological, right? Because they've practiced these tasks over and over again. So clearly something is going wrong in the way they're processing what's at stake when they're doing these tasks. So I would say that it's psychological, but it still remains to be seen exactly like what is, in those situations, when you're an artist performing in front of a crowd or you're an athlete, what exactly is happening? So we think that in the case of financial incentives, it has to do with loss aversion. But in the case of the artist performing in front of a crowd or even the sports situation where there are social incentives involved, we're still trying to figure out what's going on there.
You were able to zero in on part of the brain that influences performance. Could you tell us a little bit about this and how that particular area of the brain affects performance?
The area that we sort of focused on was the ventral striatum. And that area is deep in your brain, and it's known to be involved in processing rewards. And it's also known to have some influences on motor performance, on how you move. And what we found in our study was that area was involved in mediating the responses of how people perform for given incentives. We also found that there was, specifically in the situation where people choke during movement tasks or tasks that require some motor dexterity, there's sort of a disconnect between ventral striatum, this part deep in your brain, and the motor cortex, which is involved in encoding your movements and how you move through when you're doing certain skilled tasks. So we think that a decoupling between the ventral striatum or these areas not being able to talk to each other very well is what causes you to choke under pressure.
Did you come across anything that was surprising?
This whole idea of loss aversion did come as a surprise to us because we were presenting people with potential gains. So we told them, you know, you're doing this task to win this money in certain situations. And so we were surprised that loss aversion could actually predict how they were going to perform in a case where there weren't any explicit losses. And we thought that the reason that this might be happening is because people are sort of reframing the task. They're thinking of it as a gain when they first see it in that condition where we offer them $100 to win. And then they start to get worried about a loss of a gain, even though they never received it. And this is sort of what gets them to choke under pressure. We were really surprised when we saw that.
Did you find any basis for developing a kind of a technique of self-help to help people and to keep them from choking under pressure?
I think it can be applied. So we're still trying to figure out exactly what the best cognitive strategies are to go about stopping people from choking under pressure. I think what our research suggests is that if you are worried about one of those people that are very worried about losses, one thing that you can do is to try and sort of not put so much stress on a single event, but rather think about all of the possibilities that you have to do well. So maybe keep a positive attitude where you're not so focused on loss. That can sort of help you. But the other thing that's interesting is what the research suggests by framing incentives properly. Given somebody's loss aversion, you can have a drastic improvement in their performance. So as an example, your boss, if he knows your loss aversion, when he's setting up your bonuses, he can say, look, I know that you're very loss averse, so you'll actually respond better to an unconventional bonus where it's framed as a loss if you don't successfully achieve a task. So endow your employee with money and then take away if they're unsuccessful. And this way, you're sort of capitalizing on what their motivational tendencies are and how they process loss aversion. And this might be able to actually help them do better and achieve more of their bonus.
That was Dr. Vikram Chibb from the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, in Pasadena, California. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.